I had the good pleasure this morning going to Chattanooga to the airport to pick up our speaker. And unfortunately, we got caught up in about an hour and a half traffic jam. And so we had a chance to share a little bit, and Scott was with us. And I've heard him on several occasions, and I really like gotten a lot out of everything that he's had to say. And he means a lot to me, and I know that he'll mean a lot to y'all after this talk, for y'all that haven't heard him. Let's give a warm North Georgia welcome to Tom B. from Charlotte, North Carolina.
$200 CAT scan, huh? You can tell from the crowd here tonight that the Braves were rained out. It's good to see some folks here tonight. There's a bunch of people from Bowling Green, Kentucky. Some friends I met down in Waycross at the Womp by the Stomp, where I had some of the best collard greens I ever had in my life. You ever want any collard greens, go down to Waycross and get hold of Bobby. He'll take you to the place, I'll tell you. More fresh vegetables than I've had in a long time. I got friends from Atlanta. I got friends from Marietta here. Saw Dot M. from Statesboro. She brought the mafia with her. Reminds me of her husband, Dr. John. Now, he used to talk in his talk, and he would brag about never taking any aspirin. He didn't take anything, And I heard him tell this story one night. A guy came up to him after the meeting and said, "You really helped me. I heard you several years ago." And he said, I've drunk a lot of liquor since I heard you, but I ain't never took another aspirin. I'm Tom Brady, Jr., and I'm an alcoholic. And I haven't had a drink since July 20th, 1965. Which... I look out at this bunch tonight, and there's some of the greatest screw-ups and misfits in the whole world sitting here in this audience, including me. And it's Saturday night, and we ain't drinking. Why? You know? I guess many of you, like me, were very surprised when the world didn't change when you got sober. That was a grave awakening for me. You know, I thought the world was going to change, and I wouldn't have to somehow. Alcoholic thinking, what Johnny H. calls the keen alcoholic mind. And the program doesn't promise that the world will change. And I suppose some of you like me were really taken aback when those old character defects you thought you got rid of in step 6 and 7 kind of snuck back into your mind again. That'll throw you for a loop, but the program doesn't promise that we're going to be washed white as snow forever. What the program promises is that the obsession to drink will be removed, and that I will be restored to my right mind. What the program offers is sanity. I remember one of the old-timers in the program from up in New York, a guy named Tom P., and he was Bill Wilson's running buddy for a long time. He edited the 12 and 12 for Bill. And I heard Tom say one time, and it took me years to understand it, what this program gives us is sanity. Everything else, he said, is marginal. But once the alcoholic insanity blinders are removed in what we call a spiritual awakening, Malachi, the book says all sorts of remarkable things happen. And so you're looking at a man that's been transformed into a new person, because I no longer have the desire to drink and haven't had it for many years. And if you'll meet the conditions of the system of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the program's a system, if I fulfill the conditions of the system, the program will do for me exactly what it says it will do. If I don't fulfill the conditions of the system, it will not do that. And it took me many years, and I almost died before I saw the truth in that. Now, there's a bunch out here tonight, there's probably some alligators. That's what we call real low-bottom drunks in North Carolina, gators. Now, a gator's a guy that lays in the tall grass, spread eagle on his back, with his eyes rolled back in his head. You know the kind I'm talking about. And you walk up to him and screw the cap off a bottle of Thunderbird and move it under his nose, and he sits straight up just like that. You know, and give him a couple of drinks of it, and he flies for a while. Next day you go by, he's laid back in the grass, spread eagle, with his eyes roll back in his head, you know. That's the way a gator does. And there's probably some winos and there's probably some winettes out there, too. I remember a story I heard years ago told by a man named Jack O from down in San Antonio, Texas, and I've never forgotten it. Talking about winos. He said a couple of winos shook two under a bridge one day. He said, winos don't wake up, they shake two. And he said, one of them said to the other one, said, man, I had the best dream I ever had in my life last night. And the other one said, what'd you dream? He said, I dreamed my mama called me up, gave me $50, told me to go spend the whole day at Disneyland. And the other wino said, you go? He said, yeah. So I saw Donald Duck and Goofy, and I rode all the rides and looked at all the pretty girls. Best time I ever had in my life. The other wino said, that ain't nothing. I had a better dream than that. He said, oh, yeah, what'd you dream? He said, man, I dreamed I had a luxury apartment. And he came a knock on the door, and these two women came in. They had a case of Jack Daniels and started taking their clothes off. The other wino was all caught up in his story. He said, why in the hell didn't you call me? He said, I did, but your mama says you're at Disneyland. Certain stories we never forget. Now, I'm an alcoholic. And that means that I have four great desires that have caused me and will cause me just about all the trouble in my life. One of those desires is, I have a great desire to be in control. Another one is, I have a great desire to understand everything. Another is, I have a great desire to always be right. And another is, I have a great desire to always be comfortable. And I'm never comfortable unless I'm in control and know everything, you know, and like that. So you can read about me on pages 60 to 62 in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, when I say I'm an alcoholic, I mean the kind of person that always believe in anything that feels good should be done to excess. Any of y'all like that? If it feels good, overdo it. You know, when I drank too much, and I gambled too much. Sometimes a day I'll sit down and eat, you know, and eat too much. And hell, I remember when I found out sex felt good. I was by myself just like all of y'all were. In spite of some dire warnings from my mother about a certain part of my anatomy rotting off and telling me I was going to go blind, I reasoned that I feel so good, I'll just keep on till I'm nearsighted. One of my first great successes in life. When I say I'm an alcoholic, I mean I'm the kind of person who likes to do everything at once and do it all perfectly. I wake up in the morning, and before my body starts, my mind's in gear. I gotta. And I gotta do it all perfectly. It's all gotta be just right, and when I'm in the middle of doing something, you know, something else comes to mind, I gotta jump right up and do it. I'm like a ping pong ball, bouncing all over the place. Y'all ever try to pee and comb your hair at the same time? Now, women may be able to do that, you know, I don't know. Have you tried it? I believe she has. You know, when you're 6'3", you're going to make a mess. And I've always been a great starter and a poor finisher. Everything I ever did in my life, full speed ahead, you know. And with my drinking, it was like this. When I was hurting, it was full speed ahead. Help me, help me, help me, help me, help me. And then a bad thing would happen to me. Things would get better. And I'd pull it back on stop and go right back and do the same thing that got me in pain to begin with. Now, that doesn't seem like a big problem. But the program, as I understand it, is a program of practice. That means you follow through. You do it, you do it, you do it, you do it, you do it. Whether you want to do it or not makes no difference. You do it, you do it, you do it. It is not a program of just beginning. It is a program of continuance. The book reminds us over and over that a continuance of this way of life. You know, our sobriety depends on that. We have a daily reprieve. How many people you seen come in full speed? You know? And a week or so later, they're feeling better, and they say, well, I don't need to go to meeting tonight. Doesn't seem like a big problem. But we are great starters and poor finishers. I always believed in magic. I like magic. That's the reason I liked alcohol. The whole world will be falling down, take a couple drinks of that flit, and everything's okay. Only trouble with magic is magic, by definition, is illusion. It does not last. And I believed in it. I went to ministers and asked them to fix me. Work your magic. I went to doctors and asked them to fix me. Work your magic. You know, anybody. Work your magic. I came to AA initially and said to AA, well, I'm here. Work your magic. You know? And there is no magic. There's work. And I have a problem with that. Because I'm lazy. Any of y'all come upon that in your inventory? If you didn't, you better go back and look again. I don't care if you get out there and work 100 hours a week on your job, you know? If your sponsor told you to read 5 pages in the big book and you ain't read it, you're lazy. Okay? When it comes to getting well, many of us are not willing to do the work involved, in spite of the fact, how many hours did I spend working on being an alcoholic? Tell me a harder job than that. And yet I expect sobriety to be a slide. Fix me. Fix me. I was always interested in results. I didn't care about the process. Just give me the results. I see people come in AA now and they sit down like I sat down when I first got here and say, well, my seat's in the chair. You know? I've been here 10 minutes. I should have 10 years of sobriety. Always results, no process. This is a program of process. It's not, sobriety's not an event. It's just not that way. Okay? And all of my life, I have been searching for something. All of my life, there has been an empty place inside of me that needed filling, even when I was a little old boy. And I'd sit up in a chinaberry tree and I'd do my deep thinking in a chinaberry tree and I'd say, I got a good mama and a good daddy and good friends and everything else, but something's missing. And I don't know what it is. But if I ever find it, that's going to be wonderful. I'll be complete. I'll be whole. And I'll get back to that as we go. As far back as I can remember, I was afraid. Okay? And I had a lot to be afraid about, but I'll get back to that in just a minute with you. I was afraid because I was the ugliest baby you ever saw in your life. You know? And I think I'm an alcoholic from the get-go. And alcoholism in this program is defined, if you want to call it that, very simply. If when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic, it says. Now, I'm an alcoholic because when I put alcohol in this body, my body sends me a sudden and complete and urgent message. It always did, it always will. And that message was, go get some more of that stuff and get it right now. Every time I put alcohol in this body responded in that way. And no matter what my intentions were, my body took over with what Dr. Silkworth calls the phenomenon of craving, which is a physical compulsion beyond mental control. My friends, the scientists call it a biochemical genetic disorder having to do with the hypothalamic information control center in my brain. They say when I ingest ethyl hydroxide, it turns into acetaldehyde, which combines with dopamine, which produces tetrahydroisoquinoline, and I lose control. AA says I'm allergic to alcohol. Somehow I like that a lot better, you know? And the program says that there's something wrong with my mind, you know? But it doesn't say that I'm insane in the general use of that word. As a matter of fact, it says I may be normal in every respect in my life, but when it comes to alcohol, I am strangely insane. There's a big difference between being schizophrenic and strangely insane. Big difference. The one is a mental problem, probably a chemical imbalance. The other is not a mental problem. strange insanity is a spiritual problem. It means that I have become disconnected from that which I must not be disconnected from. Our book says lack of power was my dilemma. Example, give a schizophrenic some Haldol. You know, give him some Thorazine. He'll clear up. You give an alcoholic some Haldol, he'd be back an hour later and say, give me some more of that shit. Y'all know it as good as I do. And traditional psychotherapeutic methods do not work. You know? Laying down on the couch. I had a little Jewish doctor. God, I love this little guy. He's a teeny little guy named Shapiro. And he loved me to death. And I was going to him, and he was a hypnotist. Now, you can't hypnotize an alcoholic. We ain't going to give up control that long. But he had me in kind of a light trance, and he was trying to tell me what a good person I was because I hated my guts, right? And I'm laying there in a trance, and he'd give me all this positive pounding, he calls it, you know. And all of a sudden, he says, you're a mensch. Well, in Yiddish, that means you're a man in the largest possible sense. And from a deep trance, I responded, bullshit. Now, Dr. Thibault said, I have this narcissistic, egocentric core dominated by feelings of omnipotence, intent at all costs on maintaining its own inner integrity. And AA says, I'm strangely insane. I kind of prefer that. And Alcoholics Anonymous says, and this is what cuts us out from the whole group, this is what makes Alcoholics Anonymous work, in my opinion. We may have been mentally and physically ill, we're also spiritually sick. And then they say something which is very powerful. Once the spiritual malady is overcome, then we straighten out mentally and physically. Wow. What's a spiritual malady? Well, I'm an idealist. Any others out there? A perfectionist. A hypersensitive romantic dreamer. Never been satisfied with you, me, or this world like it was. I always had to have more. And in order to get that more, I went out there and manipulated and conned and shucked and jived and tap danced and schemed and lied in every way possible to control the situation and the circumstances and the people around me. They call it self-will run riot in the book. I think it's a very apt term. And when you do this, people rebel. And a wall came up between me and these people, and I became shut off from my brothers and my sisters, and therefore, from my God. I believe that with all my heart. I was separated, isolated, disconnected. And any person who is disconnected is spiritually ill in the deepest sense of that word. And I love the AA solution. It's so simple, some people have to call it simplistic, you know. Oh, it's too simple, it won't work. Well, it seems that way, doesn't it? But what the program says is, you know, you built a wall. First, you got to quit playing God. It didn't work. I like that logic. Hereafter, in this drama of life, God's going to be the director. You make some changes in attitude there. And then you go to that wall, and you identify the stones in it that you have put there. Never mind the other person. And then you take a list of what you found to somebody else, and you check it out to make sure you haven't missed anything. And then you ask God to make a hole in that wall, listen, large enough to take away those things that cut into your usefulness to God and others. And you step through that wall, and you make restitution to your brothers and sisters. You reconnect with them, and when you reconnect with them, you reconnect with your God. And when you reconnect with your God, you regain the power to overcome the strange insanity. And when that's overcome, you don't drink. And if you don't drink, your body will never send you that message again. And that's clarity itself to me. As an intellectual, I didn't understand that. But you see, AA is not an intellectual program. It's not based on thought. It's not based on feelings. It's based on action, like every spiritual program. Jesus didn't say, sit around and think. He said, go do these things. Bill Wilson didn't say, sit around and think. Go do these things. What was read tonight and how it works, when you read how it works, it says, these are the steps we took, not these are the steps we thought about. So it's a spiritual program based on action. No matter what I'm thinking, no matter how I'm feeling, there's certain things I've got to do as an alcoholic if I want to maintain my sobriety. That's it. And I didn't like that. I wanted to think about it a little while. Can you imagine me trying to explain to an intellectual, you know, him coming from up here and me coming from the heart, and this is a heart deal, you know? It's a spiritual deal all the way. And I'm trying to explain to him, and he says to me, well, you must be an awfully strong person to have been sober that long. And I'd say, no, sir, it's when I admitted my weakness I started getting well. And he would say to me, and rightly so, that makes no sense. And I'd respond, I know it doesn't. And he said, well, you must have fought awfully hard to win the victory over alcohol. And I said, no, sir, I surrendered. And he says, that makes no sense. I said, I know it doesn't. Well, what do you do to stay sober? I go to meetings. Oh, group therapy. No, sir, it's not group therapy. Just a bunch of drunks sit around and talk to each other. We lie to each other a hell of a lot. And he says, you know, as an intellectual, that makes no sense. And I said, I know it doesn't. Well, what else do you do? I got a sponsor. Oh, a psychotherapist. No, sir, he's a plumber. And the guy's beside himself by now saying, that makes no sense. I said, I know it doesn't. What else do you do? Well, I got this 12-step program. Oh, the great metaphysicians and theologians got together and laid you out a path. No, sir, it was put together by a bunch of drunks. And he says, that makes no sense. I said, I know it doesn't. He said, well, who founded this thing anyway? I said, a bankrupt stockbroker and a proctologist who had lost his ass. And the guys, you know, he's really mentally ill by this time, you know, because such a thing will not work, will it? It is too simple, isn't it? You know, and there's a radical change in this program, a thing which is totally unnatural for me. This program is not based on me and how to meet my needs. As a matter of fact, the book that I read says that my very life as an ex-problem drinker depends upon my constant thought of others and how I may help meet their needs. Drop that on an egomaniac like me. I got to think about that one for a while, you know. And get back to the fear. I scared to death all my life. I didn't know what I was scared of. You know, I was an ugly baby. People say, how you know that? I said, my mama told me. That's good food for a psychiatrist, I'll tell you that. I told a psychiatrist that one time. He said, ooh, that must have been traumatic for you. I said, no, I've seen my baby pictures. Mama's right. I was ugly. And as a group, things didn't get much better. I was one of them skinny little old boys. The shoulder blades protruded all the way out, you know, and I'd try to compensate by bringing my shoulders around. My chest would disappear. It was a no-win situation. And Mama made me wear knickers. Any of you guys have to wear knickers? And my little old leg is that big, and the knicker hole was that big, and is always falling down. Somebody told me not long ago, knickers are coming back. I said, not on my ass, ain't. I hated those things. I was skinny, you know, and I thought I was ugly, and it hasn't been told I was ugly. I mean, that's the way I started my life. You ugly, you know? And then I started getting these splotches on my face, you know? I love freckles on other people. But, man, I had them all over me. I had freckles where people have never reported ever having any freckles. But I had them there, you know, and I didn't like them. And I didn't like me. I didn't like the way I looked. Didn't like the way I felt. Didn't like this emptiness inside me, you know? I always wanted to be a macho man. I figured that'd take care of everything. Be big, strong, courageous, you know. And my mother had four big brothers, and they were macho guys. And the most macho was my Uncle Durwood. They called him Dud. And Dud was a motorcycle cop back in the days when they wore riding breeches and leather spats up to their knees. And he had a harness across here with silver bullets stacked in it. And pearl handle 38 sitting high on his hip, you know. He smelled like gunpowder and shaving lotion, and he squeaked when he walked. And by God, that's macho. And you know something funny about this in retrospect? When I was sitting behind my Uncle Dud on that motorcycle with my arms around him, I was not afraid. Even then, I needed a higher power. Even then. And that's retrospect. To make me feel okay. All right. Uncle Dud will be 88 November the 10th. I love him to death. He's one of the biggest liars on the face of God's earth. And I love it when he lies, you know? Every time that he tells a story, and I know the stories by heart, the guy that he captures gets a foot taller and 300 pounds more weight, you know? And my aunt sits there and says, "Oh, shut, you lying again." He said, "You stay out of this. This is my damn story." And he's still a macho man. Be 88 years old soon, you know? Not long ago, he had blood clots and cutting loose in him, and he was in the hospital there trying to clear those things out. And I heard about it, and I drove from Charlotte to Burlington, where he lives, walked in his hospital room, didn't even say hello. I said, "You can't die." That's the first thing I said to him. He said, "Why?" I said, "Because I need you as a hero." He said, "Oh, well, I won't die then." And he didn't. That's macho. Now, I used to look back on my childhood, especially my mama, who was a black belt Southern Baptist, and I figured I had every reason in the world to drink. She demanded perfection of me, demanded perfection, and even perfection wasn't enough. I'd come home with straight A's on my report card, and there was an unspoken comment that I'd get from her. You know those unspoken comments? "You can do better than this." How the hell do you do better than that? You know? And she tried to relive her life through me. She would have breathed for me if she could. You understand the kind of person I'm talking about? Very strong will, very dominant, brilliant. Lady with a sixth grade education who was brilliant. And I hated her for years. I had lots of psychiatrists help me do that. One of them told me if I had a mother like yours, I'd drink more liquor than you do. I was in the psycho ward, you know, and locked up. He wouldn't let her come see me. I got to tell you something about Mom. A lot of people putting their parents down nowadays. You know, my mama's dead now. God rest her soul. She's running heaven now. God ain't got a chance, I'll tell you that. But if I called my mama tonight and said, "Come to Dalton, Georgia, I need you to die for me," my mother would be here. She was one of those unfortunate people who did not know how to overtly express love. Hugging and kissing I didn't see, you know. She didn't know how to do that. She knew how to bail me out of jail. She knew how to give me money. She knew how to remind me of every mistake I'd ever made and tell me if I did it her way, everything would be okay. But my mother would die for me. I knew that. Let's cut her some slack. While we're doing all this nitpicking, you know, and we're talking about all this abuse and harassment, and I know it goes on. Let me tell you the reductio ad absurdum happened up in North Carolina last week. A six-year-old boy kissed a friend on the playground and was charged with sexual harassment. That's reducing it to absurdity. Kids are going to grow up, if we keep on this way, afraid to touch one another. We're going to live in a totally disconnected world, and God help us if that happens. My childhood wasn't bad. I had the finest man for a daddy you've ever seen in your life. It took me a long time to see this. It's funny, you look back on your childhood and it looks so dark, you know, and then you find one good thing. And before you know it, when you find one, there's two. And then there's three, and then there's four, and then the memories come flooding back. And you say, "It wasn't so bad. It's pretty balanced, as a matter of fact." My daddy's the finest man I ever knew. He's my hero, my number one hero. And we need heroes in this program. I'm not talking about idols. Those poor guys and gals who happen to have the gift of gab and make talks at conventions and things, and you put them up on a pedestal and wait for them to make a mistake so you can rip them to pieces. I'm talking about heroes. And heroes are the people that get out there and do it. If they make a mistake, they get up and they do it again. I read the other day that experience was a great teacher. It'll help you recognize a mistake when you make it again. And we need heroes in this program. And I believe that with all my heart. My dad is my number one hero, sweetest, kindest, gentlest, best man I've ever known in my life. And I'd love one day to be like him. I lived in a little textile mill town, as a matter of fact, called Irwin, North Carolina. And I had an extended family. I don't know what's happened to extended families in these days. We hardly have families, much less extended families. Everybody on that block was like brother and sister to me, and every parent was like parent to me. I'd sleep at your house, I'd eat at your house, I'd bathe at your house, and if I misbehaved at your house, any parent had the right to punish me. Now, punishment was sure and swift, you know? What they told us in the mill village, you have to excuse my language, boy, if you do that, I'll whoop your ass. And when you did it, guess what they did? exactly what they said they'd do. There's nothing abusive about that as far as I'm concerned, you know. And any of the parents could do it. And I remember those people today with great fondness. You know, I remember Lena. She lived on the corner, and she was a dark-skinned lady, and she's the best cook on the block. Man, that woman could cook. I loved to eat over at her house. And she loved to eat, too. Now, she'd eat anybody on the table. Lena was fat. That's what I'm trying to say. And you know, I had this great shock of snow white hair on top of all them freckles, and all macho uncles called me Puddinhead. And that's not a macho name. I know that now, you know. And I walked in the group one night not long ago, Malachi, and this young kid, he's been there about 6 months, said, "How you doing, Puddinhead?" I said, "You son, but you got to be sober 5 years before you call me Puddinhead." I used to love to hug Lena. When you hug Lena, you had a titty in both ears. It was the most wonderful feeling in the world. And Lena would rub me on the head and say, "I love you, Puddin'." I just go, Oh, it's the most comforting feeling in the world, you know. And I had good friends. Her son, Bill Jr., was my friend, and John Q. next door was my friend, and old man Lucas would come by the house with a wheelbarrow going down to slop the hogs. And he'd call me, I'd go out and get in the wheelbarrow, and we'd ride down to Hog Pen, you know, and I'd go over and wade and catch crawdads and drink water out of the creek while he slopped the hogs. Then I'd walk home barefoot along the path, you know, and just being, you know, just being. I truly believe that when they talk about rigorous honesty in this program, what they're talking about is be you. That's it. No sham, no pretense, no mask, no roles, no game playing. What does it say in our book? The alcoholic is very much the actor. To the world, he presents his stage character. I don't know when I stopped being and started pretending, but I did it at a pretty early age. And that's the depth of dishonesty, is pretending to be something that I'm not. Never mind cheating and stealing. Those are minor. Okay? And I used to go to the movie on Saturday. It cost 9 cents. For 9 cents, and popcorn's a nickel a box. Fresh popcorn. Not popcorn that's been laid in the back room for 2 years and they charge you $2.50 for it. Fresh popcorn. And we loved to go up there. And the man next door ran the theater, so when you ran out of popcorn, you'd stick your box out there and he'd fill it up again. And I spent the whole day at the movies for 9 cents. See a double feature Western. And a couple of good serials like Flash Gordon and Buck Rogers, you know, the original spaceman, and I'm dating myself, and that's all right, I don't care anymore. And some good cartoons, you know, like Wile E. Coyote, who is one of my role models to this day. You talk about a guy that sticks to it, he loses every time. But he gets up and buys him another rocket from Acme and takes off again. I love that one in the Batman suit, you know, he's flying, turns his head and goes... I really identify with that, you know. And the Cowboys were my hero. I'm talking about you young kids have to watch TBS at 4 o'clock Sunday morning, you know, to see any of these guys. They're tremendous. Sit up and wait for them. You know, there it was Rocky Lane and Sunset Carson. And Wild Bill Elliott wore 2 6-guns, silver ones backwards, you remember? And you draw down on Wild Bill, he'd spin them 6-guns and shoot the guns out of your hands because Cowboys was very polite in them days. Spin him back, put him in his holster. That old square jaw, big looking man. My favorite cowboy was a dude named Lash LaRue. They called him Lash because he carried a bullwhip. You draw down on Lash, he whipped the gun out of your hand. Lash went beyond everybody else, and he was my number one hero. And I was watching him one day, and he'd run all the bad guys out of town, and he was standing up on the roof of the saloon. And he popped his whip and whistled, and his horse come running by. And he popped it again and jumped in the saddle and rode off in the sunset. Well, tears come to my eyes. That was a moving experience. I said, "Look at Lash." And I sat there and watched him again and again and again, you know. And you got to emulate your heroes. So I went home, got a piece of rope, and went up on the garage. Now, my friend John Q had a pony named Beauty. I said, "John Q, go saddle up Beauty." And he did. And I said, "Now walk her past the garage." And he did, and I popped my rope and whistled and leapt into the saddle. And when I hit it, you could have heard me scream in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. You talk about unforgettable experiences. And 30 minutes later, when I got my breath back, I started wondering about Lash LaRue. That's a funny thing. I have pictures of Lash LaRue at home. I got a Lash LaRue pocket knife. Just last week, I was out in Oklahoma, and Lash died this year in May. He was about 78 or 79 years old, been married about 12 times. And people gave me his obituary. Isn't that nice? So I got a whole bunch of Lash LaRue memorabilia. And I had a good time there. Except for this emptiness inside of me and the fact that I couldn't stand me. I didn't like the way I looked. I didn't like the way I carried myself. I didn't like the kind of person that I was. I didn't like me at all. Therefore, it was very important that you did. I didn't approve of me, so it was very important that you did. And I became a disgustingly perfect little boy. And it's amazing how people buy into that. You know, I get in the Baptist church and start reciting memory verses, you know, and other mothers would say, why aren't you like Tommy? God help them if they were. And when I'd finish one success, I'd say, this is not it. This doesn't fill me inside like I need to be filled. What's next? I'll try this. 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 And none of it was the answer. When I was 15 years old, I was in Greensboro, North Carolina, the King Cotton Hotel. Isn't it strange how you remember these things? With some older, more experienced men, 17, 18 years old. And they called a cab driver and gave him $7.50, and he came back after a while, and he had this bottle of brown liquid in his hand, and the label on it said, Cream of Kentucky. I'll never forget it. And I asked my wisest friend, his name was Egghead Baker. Egghead, well, what do we do with this stuff? What are you laughing at? People say, did you call him that because he's smart? No, his head looked like an egg. And he says, by this time they were calling me Sweet Lips, which is also not a macho name. And he says, you drink a water glass of it as fast as you can, and you drink a glass of water, and then you do it again. I followed directions to the letter. I walked in front of the bathroom mirror and watched myself take my first drink, and as God is my witness, I can picture it right now. Because that emptiness inside of me was gone. It was magic. It was wonderful. And my friends got sick and passed out. I figured that's a great waste. So I waited till they were all passed out, and I called a cab driver, and I got me a pint of Cream of Kentucky. I had found the answer. I had the solution. This magical fix of all that was wrong with me can instantaneously be changed by this vile-tasting liquid. Isn't it funny when you think you found a solution in magic that it turns out to be an illusion? By the time I was 16 and 17, I was getting locked up regularly in the Wake County Jail where we lived in Raleigh, North Carolina, where my mother was hostess of one of the largest Baptist churches in town. My father on the board of deacons taught Sunday school, led the singing in three more classes, you know, and their son's making the social pages. You know what I'm talking about. And I never, ever remember being locked up. I was a blackout drinker from the first day. But I remember coming to in jail. I remember coming to and wondering, what have I done this time? Is anybody dead? Y'all never did that, I expect. And Mama come bail me out, you know. Daddy was a man of few words, you know. I called him one day, I said, I'm in jail, come get me. That's just the way it was. He said, son, you got yourself in there. You can get yourself out. Hung up the phone. Daddy got right to the point. You know, used to when I was drinking, I'd read the Bible a lot. My daddy liked the Bible, so, and I kind of do too today. It won't bite you. It's not conference approved, but it's a pretty good book, you know. And I get to reading the Bible, and I was drunk one night, and I'd been reading the Prodigal Son. God, I was dangerous, man. I was loaded for bear. And me and my daddy were arguing. I said, well, give me what's mine, and I'll leave. He said, you wearing it. Get your ass out the door. By the time I was 23, following the lead of this solution, I'd had over 1,000 stitches taken in my face alone as a result of drinking. I had this habit of driving cars when I was drunk and running into immovable objects, you know, and sticking my head in and out windshields. I ripped off my face a couple of times doing that. But you see, I had this obsession. I believed it with all my heart, with all my heart. Someday, somehow, if I just handle it right, I'm going to be able to control and enjoy my drinking. I had the alcoholic obsession. I was deeply into that insanity. It ruled my life. I was totally out of control and didn't know it. Alcohol told me when to drink. Come on, Tom. I won't hurt you this time. And I'd go again. Come on, Tom. You had a little trouble last time. You're having trouble this time, you know. And I'd go again. And alcohol will lie to you. It'll lie to you. And that obsession will take you right there. I went to the psycho ward. Mo was talking eloquently about that this afternoon. And of course, being somebody that always rose to the top, I had to be the best nut in the psycho ward. I got to watching the schizophrenics, and hell, it wasn't long before I could out-schizophrenic the schizophrenics. I saw guys getting shock treatment, asked the doctor, can I have some of them? That's nuts! You know, and they'd come through, and this one guy was real shaky, and they'd hit him in the butt with a needle every now and again when he got out of control, you know, and he looked like it felt real good afterwards. So I got out of control a couple times. They hit me in the butt with that needle, and it was nice, man. I used to stand up there on the ninth floor behind the screen wire. You want to talk about insanity? And scream at the world, you son of a bitches can't get me now. You know, I got thrown out of that psychiatric ward. I got thrown out. And let me tell you the reason the psychiatrist gave me. I can't help you, son. You're an alcoholic, and I love you too much. Isn't it something? How somehow we can get people to love us too much, Malachi? Isn't it something? It's a gift, but it can be a curse. A terrible curse. And I went to a religious home for alcoholics, you know, and boy, that was something. Treatment consisted of preaching on Tuesday night, Thursday night, Saturday night, Sunday morning, Sunday night, you know. We formed a gospel quartet down there, called ourselves the Four Roses. We were good. Some of y'all have heard my friend Bryant B. from North Carolina. He sang lead in that quartet. I sang top tenor. Had a boy sang baritone, stuttered, couldn't talk a lick. When he sang, he just sang so clear. And a great big old 300-pound Methodist minister singing bass. I'm telling you, it rolled out of him. And we was good, you know. Of course, none of us stayed sober till we went to AA. And only one of us doesn't survive. Three of us are sober in AA, okay? But the minister was found in a ditch, dead, overdosed. Knew more about the Bible than any man I ever met in my life. Best preacher I have ever heard. A wonderful human being who had this obsession. Someday, somehow, if I just handle it right. I was laid up at Mom and Daddy's house drunk one day. I didn't have nowhere else to go, so I found them. You know, they moved while I was in the service. They did. They moved. Didn't tell me where they went. That's got to tell you something, but I found them. And I was laid up at the house drunk, and Mama went down the street to this little florist shop in the neighborhood, you know, and the fellow that run it was named Simon Parker. He's dead now. And Simon was real happy this day, and he had this little medallion hanging around his neck, you know, and Mama says, what you so happy about, Simon? He said, Miss Brady, I've never told you this, but I'm an alcoholic. And he said, I've been sober 7 years, and he gave me this little token last night. Isn't it beautiful? And he's just full of himself. He said, if you ever know anybody I can help, Miss Brady, you just let me know. And Mama took him by the arm and said, come with me, Simon. And I went to Alcoholics Anonymous with the same master attitude. Understand it. Manipulate it. Control it. And I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. There's 12 steps over here, 12 traditions over here, and a big book in front of the man standing up in front, a blue book, you know. And I said, all I got to do is memorize those steps, memorize those traditions, memorize what's in that book. I'll be president of Alcoholics Anonymous very shortly. And don't y'all laugh at me. Every damn one of you said the same thing to yourself. You Al-Anons don't laugh at us neither. If I pull the bus of life into this room tonight, every one of us would go for the steering wheel. And Al-Anons would be first.
Let me drive the damn car.
So I went to memorizing. I can quote large portions of the big book to you, but I don't have to anymore. And that's a great freedom. But that's all I had. It was my usual way of doing things, you know, get their attention, get their acceptance, get their approval, because I still hated me real bad. Some of y'all may think self-hate's not a big problem, may think you don't have it. It's my number one defect of character. You know how to spot it? When somebody tells you to do a good job, do you give them three or four reasons why you should have done it better? When somebody tells you you're a good person, do you give them four or five reasons why they shouldn't believe that? When someone says that they love you, do you respond like, how can you love me? Better take a look. Better take a look. When we get sober, we become great givers, but lousy receivers. Lousy receivers. I remember giving a guy a tie one night that I had on because he liked it. And my friend said to him, he'll give you anything he's got, but don't you ever try to give him anything. He'll run away. Isn't it strange that the people we hurt the most are the people we love the most? Because they have the audacity to try to love us. And we're convinced in our hearts, or I was, I ain't worth loving. I didn't know this. It's a character defect. And a character defect is an unconscious, habitual reaction to something that happens to you. That's what it is. You don't know you're doing it. It's automatic. Somebody says something and the tape starts playing. Somebody says something else and the tape starts playing. And this program is supposed to reach down in and throw out that old tape, or at least put a new message over the old one so that I react differently. I love you, Tom. Yeah, I know you're doing. I love you, too. You did a good job, Tom. Thank you. I know I did. You know? You're a good person, Tom. I have a hard time with that one. And I have a hard time with this to this day. I talked at an alcohol and drug school a couple years ago, and the evaluations came back. It was a sheet of paper that would cover the end of this room here. And the lady who knows me real well said, there's 900 and some evaluations here. I've already marked the two that are negative to save you the trouble of looking for. That's the God's truth. Because I would have thought about them and not the other 900 and some that were positive. You see? And it's not an easy thing to get rid of. It's not easy at all. I have to watch myself continually. And sometimes change in midstream when I start into my old routine. Stop and say, whoa, whoa, thank you. You know, please watch for that. They call it remorse in the big book. I don't think they give enough attention to remorse. Self-hate. A feeling of worthlessness. I memorized all this stuff in AA. And I could spit it out, you know, but nobody didn't care. They didn't care. Yeah. I met some hateful people in Alcoholics Anonymous. All of them was ugly and they were profane and they talked in circles and they called them old-timers. One old guy in Burlington, North Carolina named Bill Crumpler, he's dead now, God rest his soul, you know. I called him Grumpy. I hated his guts. Grumpy'd wait for me at meetings. He denied it, but I knew he was waiting for me. He'd be standing inside the door when I came in. He'd point that finger at me and say, how you doing, boy? Oh, I didn't like that. And I'd say, fine. And he'd go to cussing and back me in the corner and tell me how I was doing. That's a scary thing. Somebody can read you like they got x-ray vision. And he talked in circles. Yeah, he talked in circles. Boy, you can't think your way into good living. You got to live your way into good thinking. I think to myself, shut up, you ugly bastard. But I didn't say anything to him because I was scared of him. You understand? And the one I always loved was, boy, how come you're always looking for God? He ain't lost. I hated him when he said that. I had to get him on my side. So one Sunday afternoon, I found a drunk in a cabin. Didn't have no indoor plumbing. Been in there drunk for 2 months. He's about as blue as that lady's suit up here on the front. And I sent him to the hospital, getting him taken care of. Got a lady down the street. We shoveled out that place. I mean, it was absolutely unbelievable, you know. I got the guy back from the hospital. He's going to live. I called Grumpy. I wanted him to come see what I had done so he would approve of me, right? And then going through all that mess in that cabin, I found a gallon of liquor. And when Grumpy got there, me and that guy both was drunk. And he was totally unimpressed by it. He shook his head and mumbled an oath and walked off, you know. And the thing about these guys, I hated them then. I always call for help when it was too late. Didn't y'all do that? When you're beyond help, you call for help. I used to sit around and the booze would run out and the TV test pattern would go off and I'd say to myself, shit, I need some help. And I called Grumpy one morning about 3 o'clock in the morning. Before I could say a word, he said, "Boy, don't you ever call me drunk again." He said, "Matter of fact, don't you ever call me again. If you want to get sober, you know where we meet. And don't call me to come get you. You can walk." And he said, "Frankly, I don't care if you ever get sober." I did mention I'm a sensitive person, didn't I? Man, I said things about that man that shouldn't be said about anybody. And I bless him tonight, and he's one of my heroes. And he never changed. Last time I saw him, he's dying with bone cancer. And I walked in his hospital room. I've been sober 16 years. And I walked in his hospital room, and up came the finger, and he pointed at me and said, "Boy, you'll never make it." He had this way of humbling you, you know. God, I miss him, you know. And we look at all the ones that are dead and gone. They may be dead, but they ain't gone. As long as I'm around, Grumpy's here. He's here, you know. It's his thinking that motivates me. It's my heroes that motivate me and keep me going. It's what they taught me that I pass on to somebody else. Like Mo said today, there's very little that's original about this. Knowing all that I knew, the longest I ever stayed dry was 89 days for the next 7 years. Now, I'm going to tell you, I did my real suffering after I got here. It's like being that close to the switch and not being able to reach it. And everybody else seemed to be reaching it. It's like Chuck C. used to say, the turtles of life were passing me by like they was riding motorcycles. And I'm standing there saying, what about me? What is the matter with me? And I began to totally believe that even AA wasn't going to work for me. I didn't know it then, but that was a good thing to happen. Because I was one of those step skippers. I'd jump around and I found one I wanted to get into, and I got into meditation. I knew how to pray. Hell, I'm a Southern Baptist. That's my second disease. I am recovering from that. And somebody told me when I got up here and I said, "Don't preach." I said, "Hell, I can't help it. I'm a Southern Baptist." I found out who the best meditators were. These guys that shaved all the hair off the head and wore these orange bathrobes and squatted down all funny on the floor and chanted, "Om." Now, I'm not making fun of that tradition. It's an ancient, honored, wonderful tradition. You see, that wasn't what I was interested in. I was interested in results. I'd seen these guys lay down on a bed of nails. I'd seen them walk across hot coals, be locked in a coffin for 2 days, slow down their breathing and live. That's what I wanted. All of y'all would approve of me then. Hey, damn, look at Tom. He's walking across a bed of hot coals. Look at Tom. He's in that coffin. He's going to live. That's what I wanted. Never mind the process. Couldn't find an orange bathrobe anywhere. Had to wear my old dirty blue terry cloth drinking liquor bathrobe with the cigarette burns in it. Y'all have one of them? And I'd broken my leg so many times driving drunk, I could get into lotus position with help, but I couldn't get out of it. And I'm too vain to shave my head. But I'd get my wife to help me into the lotus position, and it hurt, man. And I'd sit there and say, "Oh," waiting for my spiritual awakening to happen. I mean, I'm a Baptist, man. Spiritual awakening means being a bush lighting up, you know. The Bible says that Moses was slow of speech. That meant Moses stuttered. Can you imagine you laying in your tent one night and you get this message to go up to the mountain, and you go up there and you say, "Who are you?" And a big voice comes down and says, "I am." And a bush lights up. Right after I wet my pants, I'd have started stuttering too. It doesn't surprise me at all that Moses stuttered. And I'd get down there and chant, and I hurt. And I don't know much about God, you know. And that's all right, because God knows everything about me. My deal is to relate to God, to address God as often as I can, to have a little conversation with God, a little remembrance of God. Thank you for that tree. Thank you for that flower. Thank you for that meeting. Thank you for that person. And think of him as often as I can, you know. But comprehending him? Nah. It's not necessary. Because he comprehends me. And he's got a sense of humor, that I know. Can you imagine that? Here's a Southern Baptist boy sitting down there in a filthy bathrobe chanting. And God standing up there looking down and saying to Peter, there he is again. Peter says, who? God said, Puddinhead. I wish you'd get rid of that robe. That thing stinks, man. He's sitting down, his legs all locked up. He's hurting. Ain't the boy got no sense? And what does ohm mean anyway? And then a blessed event happened to me. Horrible, it seemed, but blessed. I hit bottom. I love the beautiful, beautiful poetic way that the Jewish philosopher Martin Buber talks about that. He said, it's that point when the ghost above you and the spirit within you whisper to one another the confession of their non-salvation. Another way to put it is, oh God, I have had it. Please help me. And that morning, right around July 20th, 1965, I knew I couldn't drink. And it wasn't up here, it was down here. And I knew, I think for the first time, I couldn't quit. And I knew I was going to die. Now, mind you, by this time, I've gotten myself on 5 years probation. I had a 2-year active sentence on the chain gang hanging over my head. I'm about to lose a job. My wife and daughter had left again. You see, alcohol said had such a hold on me, when I knew I was going to drink, I'd start giving presents to my wife and daughter before I got drunk, because I knew I was going to and there was nothing I could do about it. And then they knew too, and they'd leave. And I didn't have a driver's license. I was never supposed to drive again in the state of North Carolina. Permanent revocation. And I made a profit out of Grumpy. I walked back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I blessed my feet. Please understand me. Old James Taylor from up North Carolina wrote a song one time, said, I guess my feet know where they want me to go. Mine did. And my feet brought me back to you. Had it been left up to my head, I'd have never come. And something else had happened to me, and I didn't know it, and I'm glad I didn't, because if I had, I would have messed it up. I had surrendered. And I knew AA wouldn't work, Malachi. I knew it wouldn't work. I'd tried it, man. But I went. Grumpy was later to tell me, the only thing you ever did right, boy, was you kept going back. And I sat on the back row, and I got there late, and I left early. And people started saying strange things to me, like, we're glad you're here, Tom. We need you. And the one that always made me shudder, and we love you. And I think to myself, man, if you knew me, you wouldn't say any of these things. I'm the sorriest piece of trash that ever walked the face of the earth. But they kept saying it. And you know how we are today? A new person comes in, we give them our phone number and say, call me. They didn't do that. They got my phone number. I got 6, 8, 10 calls a day from these guys in the group. That's group sponsorship. What's happened to it? And these guys didn't tell me to do anything I could not do. I was rum-dumb when I got here. I couldn't read one line in the big book without forgetting it before I got to the second one. Some of y'all know what I'm talking about. And so they didn't get into the philosophical implications of alcoholism with me or theological discussions about any kind of God, because it would have scared me to death. They told me to do things I could do, like sit down. Now, I could do that, and people laugh at this. This is the God's truth. Shut up. I could do that. Get in the car. I could handle that. A car pulled up in front of my house every night. I went to a meeting every night the first 2 years I was in this program and didn't have a driver's license. That's group sponsorship. I didn't ask them where we were going. Wouldn't do any good. They said, get in the car. I started to say something. They said, shut up. Listen, 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 you know. And I kept going, you know. And I got to watching this man in the group, and I liked him. I'm not going to lie to you. I liked the fact he wore very expensive clothes, smoked very expensive cigars, and had a Lincoln Continental. Let's get that aside. But I liked the way this man moved, and I liked the way he talked, and he had the best eyes I've ever seen. I couldn't look him in the eye because he might see me. You understand what I'm saying? They just glittered. I sidled up to him one night, and I said, My name's Tom. I'm an alcoholic. I don't want to die. Will you be my sponsor? He turned on me and pointed his finger at me and said, boy, I've heard about you. They tell me you're not just an alcoholic. They tell me you're crazy. But I'll help you on one condition. I said, what's that? He said, we'll do it my way. I don't know but one way. It's in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, Tom. You willing to do that? And I said, yes, sir. You see, that was the difference. If he had told me that a year or 2 years before that, couldn't have said, yes, sir. I'd have said it, but I wouldn't have meant it. I hear people talking about surrender. We hear dissertations about surrender. If you're not taking directions and you're not willing to take directions in this program, you are not surrendered, in my opinion. And I was ready. And like I said, I didn't know I'd surrendered because I'd have screwed it up. I'm good at screwing up good things. Okay. You ever notice how bright your sponsor seems till you ask him to be your sponsor and then he goes stupid on you immediately? Well, that's what Harry did. He went dumb on me, you know. He said, first thing I want you to do is go to meetings early, shake everybody's hand and ask them how they're doing. I said, I don't want to go to meetings early. I don't want to shake a hand. Don't want to ask them. I don't care how they do it. Why do I have to do that? He said, boy, you don't ask me why. You do what I tell you to do. Now, a lot of people come out of these treatment centers now, and they've had a counselor. I've got a master's degree in counseling, you know. And if I told you to do something like that, the next question, some counselor, I wouldn't ask you, but some counselor would say, how's that make you feel? My sponsor didn't give a happy shit how it made me feel. And I'm not putting him down now. No one cared more about my feelings than my sponsor. But he knew I had to do these actions regardless of how I felt. And mind you, I'm separated, isolated, disconnected. And you know what he told me to do? Connect, baby. Touch some people. I didn't want to touch nobody. But I did it. You know why? Because he told me to. And I didn't miss anybody either because I knew he was watching me and he'd embarrass me and say, you missed that one. Sponsors are that way, man. They're picky people. And I started shaking hands and mumbling and looking at the floor. Y'all ever look at the floor? Man, I memorized shoe tops. And then something began to happen. I saw some ankles. Saw some shins. Saw some thighs. Saw some of the best hips I've seen in my life, man. And that's a whole number, another 3 or 4 hour talk, and I ain't getting into it because none of your damn business. But finally, I was looking them in the eye, and I was glad to see them. And I knew they were glad to see me, too. And you had an empty place inside of me. It ain't been there since. I had found the only place I had ever belonged. I had come home spiritually, okay? I found my roost. You're my family. You're not just a gang of people. I don't even know your names, but you're my family. And we're held together by a bond that's stronger than any other bond on the face of the earth. Alcoholics Anonymous may be the only true fellowship left on the face of this earth. We have a common problem, and we found a common solution. And around that living center, that higher power that gives us a solution, we bond in unity. See, the magic word in this program is we. You ever notice first word in the first edition of the big book in the foreword is we. First word in the first step is we. First word in the first tradition is our, which is a form of we, isn't it? Powerful word. I couldn't reach the switch. We could. I can't stay sober. With your help, I can. There's not an ounce of power in any individual in this room, including me. We're all powerless. We said so, didn't we? And there's more power in this room you can shake a stick at. Why? God abhors a vacuum. He abhors a vacuum. Surrender creates a vacuum. When there's a vacuum, God rushes in. Of that I'm sure. And heals. Always wanted a big spiritual awakening. Haven't had it. Glad. I'd still be on the back ward of some psycho ward if I'd had one. I would have. Oh, you should have seen that bolt of lightning, doctor. Give him some more Thorazine. Let him shuffle a while. Oh, I'm so glad. So glad. Mine's come in little spurts. I've learned things, man. I learned what love is in this program. You know, love in our society is kind of looked at as a combination of emotions and hormones. Now, some enchanted evening, you see a stranger across a crowded room, and the hormones rise, and the feelings rise, and you say, she needs some spiritual healing bad. 6 months later, the hormones are down, and the feelings are down. You roll over and look at her and say, who's this bitch? That's emotional love. The opposite of emotional love is hate. Spiritual love is quite different. I remember my sponsor telling me, you ain't got to like him, but you got to love him. I said, what does that mean? He said, pick out the man you like least in all this group. Can you do that? I said, that's easy. He said, now you don't like him, do you? I said, I can't stand him. He said, if he called you at 3 o'clock tomorrow morning and told you he was about to take a drink, what would you do? I said, I'd tell him to hang on. I'd be right over there. He said, you love him. Now, I had to think about that a little bit. He allowed me to think once in a while. In his presence. And what I gleaned from this is that spiritually, love is responsible action toward my brothers and sisters based on care, respect, and concern for them and acceptance of them as they are. And the opposite of spiritual love is not hate. It is apathy in action. I've learned that. That's what this program is all about. Not feeling the message, although we do. You know, not thinking the message, although we do, but what? Carrying the message. Action, action, loving action all the way. There ain't but one energy in this whole world, and that's love. And love's God. And everything was created by it and continues to be. And you and I have the great, great gift of being recreated by this God. Made over again. Listen, given a fresh start. And little nudges, you know. I was sitting up to college. I used to be a college professor, and I was sitting up in my college one day, and I was eating a bag lunch, and all of a sudden it dawned on me I hadn't worn a drink in over 3.5 months. I sat there and cried like a baby. This guy with the obsession to drink, right, which ruled his life, had not thought about it in 3.5 months. I cried a lot when I first got here, y'all. If you look at me, I'd start crying. I hadn't cried in years. Hadn't laughed either, unless you fell down and hurt yourself. And I cry a lot now, and I laugh a lot now, because I believe those two things are God's way of cleaning out my soul. I couldn't read. I couldn't remember anything. I'd get up front and start to read, and I'd start bawling. My sponsor would come up and get me and say, sit down, son, you're not ready yet, you know? Go pick up some coffee cups, you know? Wash them out. And then they let me make the coffee and things like that, but I couldn't read. First time I ever got up and made it through the preamble, without breaking down and bawling, they all applauded for me. You know? When I picked up my 3 months chip, you'd have thought I'd been sober 90 years. Place went crazy. And so I got a slow awakening, you know, those little nudges, those little brushes with God. You understand? Little brushes with connectedness, if you will. I know I was sitting down in a little chapel down in St. Simon's. And the little chapel down there, as I remember it, had a round stained glass window up behind the pulpit, and the carpenter was in it, but there was no cross. And I remember thinking, you know, where's the cross? And right into my head, immediately, Malachi, it's been removed, Tom, and so has yours. Little nudges, little brushes, you know. And taking the ninth step was a beautiful experience for me. See, I'm an alcoholic. I do wild things. Crazy things, like driving under a tractor trailer while in an alcoholic blackout. I did that in West Virginia when I was traveling for a major publishing company. And I was in traction for 3.5 months, unconscious for the first 3 weeks, not expected to live. My face ripped off again, my arm broken, my left leg crushed. It's a funny thing now, I laugh about it. When I came to after 3 weeks being unconscious, my mother was standing beside my bed and she said, Tommy, how could you do this to me? I became medically addicted to morphine. They got me out of the bed after about 6 weeks, and when the nurses were putting me back in the bed, they dropped me, and the steel pin that was in my thigh came out my rear end. And I had to have surgery again, which eventuated in deep venous thrombophlebitis. My leg was, you know, triple, quadruple size. Ended up staying in traction about 3.5 months. I lost from 225 pounds to 120, and I left there, not able to walk, sick as a dog. And I went home, and I met the doctor I was referred to in Lexington, Kentucky, and He's one of these bone doctors, and he said, I got a good painkiller for you. It's brand new. It's just like a strong aspirin. It's totally non-addictive, and it's called Percodan. And here's some seeking out, because you're probably having a hard time sleeping, and I couldn't walk. But I took two of them Percodan, and I knew that doctor didn't know whereof he spoke. And I called him back and cut some more. And I sat in a lawn chair for the next 5 months taking Seconal and Percodan until I could walk on my crutches. Want to guess what I did? I went and got drunk. Now, while I'm in the hospital in Wheeling, West Virginia, people visited me. A Baptist church up there, Malachi, took my wife and daughter in, let them stay up there because they were so far away, paid their way up there. A little man would come in and see me every day, just a nice little man. An Episcopal priest would come in and see me every day. I said, I'm not Episcopal. He said, doesn't make a difference. I just want to talk to you. Money was left on my bedside table to give to my wife and kid. I never thanked anybody. And I knew I had to go back up there and make amends. They were on my list. And it's a funny thing, man. I didn't have a driver's license. It's hard to make amends when you haven't got a driver's license. I wrote a lot of letters, and I'd save my money and catch a bus and go to Burlington and make amends up there. Then I'd catch a bus and go to Greensboro and make amends up there. And I'd catch a bus and go wherever. You know, it was wonderful. I never knew people loved me so much. I never knew it. And I'm on 5 years probation, right? I can't go out of the state. God provided a way. That truck driver whose cab was never hit, I went under the trailer, found out that we were all insured for millions of dollars who worked for that company, and developed mental anguish and lower back pain. And I was subpoenaed to go to West Virginia. How's that? I had to go. I laugh about that to this day. God do it, man. God will do it. If you're ready to do it, God will provide a way. And I know that with all my heart. It's when I really started believing in God when I was doing this ninth step. It was coming true, man. And I know now that the closer I hunker up to my brothers and sisters, the closer I hunker up to God. That's what He likes. He likes for me to love you. He likes for me to be kind to you and polite and nice to you. Nothing big, Tom. Keep it simple. I got sued, and I went up there and I went in this lawyer's office who was supposed to defend for my company. And he was the judge in that area, by the way, who could have put me in the slammer for what I told him. I said, before you say anything to me, I said, I got to tell you something. I'm in AA. I'm sober. And I said, I was in a blackout tonight. I had that wreck. I do not remember it to this day, which is true. Well, he tried to convince me, he and his partner, that I had had a concussion. You know, I said, no, I was in a blackout. He said, if you go to court, you're going to say that? I said, yes, sir. He said, you know, I can put you in jail. I said, yes, sir. But if I don't do it, I might drink again. He said, wait a minute. He turned around and called the insurance company that was backing us. I heard him talking a little bit. He turned around and looked at me. I said, what did the insurance man want to know? He said, he wants to know how fast I can get your ass out of town. Because you're going to tell the truth if you go to court. Well, I couldn't get an airplane out. Isn't this ironic? It was over Thanksgiving holiday, right? It's on a Thursday, on a Thanksgiving. I called this Baptist preacher. Okay? I thought he'd wet his pants. There was a long silence at the end after I told him who it was, and he says, guess who we were praying about last night at prayer meeting? I said, me? He said, yeah. I told him what I wanted to do. I want to make amends. He said, what's that? And I kind of explained to him about restitution. And he got excited, and he came over in his car, and I went to see all those people. I went to see the policeman who didn't charge me because he thought I was going to die. The doctor took 9.5 hours to put me back together on the operating table. Never put that I was drinking on the chart. He thought I was going to die. And the company never knew I was drunk, Malachi. Never did. And they kept paying my salary, so the day came when I had to call them and say, I owe you a car. I owe you a car. I don't know how I'm going to pay you for it, but you name the terms and I'll start doing it, you know? And the man responded to me, Tom, we got plenty of cars. I'm so glad you're sober. You're a brilliant young man. And if you ever want to come back in publishing, you call me. You know, people are gracious. I'd always considered them enemies. Especially me. And you know, things don't have to get better. They do, but they don't have to. You know, keep in mind, the program does not promise a bed of roses.
What the program gives me is principles which can help me to react in a different way. Emmett Fox said that with a new difficulty of any kind, it's the reception I give it mentally and the attitude I take towards it in my own thought that totally determine its effect on me. Chuck C. put it a different way. It ain't what happens to me in this world that matters. It's my reaction to it that makes the difference. The Buddha put it even clearer. Reaction, he said, is the supreme art of life. Example. Last 6 years have been the worst years I ever had in sobriety. The worst. 5 or 6 surgeries, had cancer. I married a wonderful woman, loved her very much. She decided to leave me with these words, "You're a fine man and I love you, but I don't want to be married to you anymore." My mother got Alzheimer's. My sponsor got Alzheimer's. I almost went bankrupt. Just one thing after another. You know how that goes? And when Lisa, my wife, walked away, it was like my whole life walked away, and I realized I've done it again. It took me a while to realize it. I put all my eggs in her basket. The way I felt about me depended on her. I had done it again. But I loved her. And I was suicidal. I mean, I'd go to bed at night praying not to live. And the people in my group knew I was troubled. And they made a bad mistake. Sometimes when an old-timer's troubled, everybody shies away from him. People kept away from me in droves, man. Don't do that to the old-timer. Who the hell that says 30 years takes away suffering? And I got so crazy I couldn't stand it, so I called a man that I know and respect and love, and I said, "Buck, I need a sponsor." He said, "I'll sponsor you if you sponsor me." I said, "Well, you got the worst end of this deal, you know, in the shape I'm in right now." And I went to him, and I had my list of all the ways I was wrong that caused her to leave me and all this kind of stuff. And he listened to it. He said, how long are you going to keep on with this? I said, "Well, I'm trying to find where I was wrong. That's what the program says." He said, "Tom, what did she say to you when she left?" I said, "She told me I was a fine man and she loved me, but she didn't want to be married to me anymore." He said, "You are a fine man and I love you too. Throw that list away." And he said, "I don't have the answer to your problem or, you know, solutions or anything, but we're going to go to a meeting tonight." I said, "I don't want to go to a meeting. I don't want to be around anybody." He said, "That's the reason we're going." And he said, "You need to be helping some people." And see, I'd fired all the people I was sponsoring because I wasn't capable of helping them. Big mistake. And he said, "By the end of this week, you ought to have 2 pigeons. I said, "I don't want them. I can't help them." He said, "That's why you're going to have them." And we went to meeting 7 nights a week. My God, right back to the basics. Sit down. Shut up. Get in the car. I'm telling you the truth now, and I began to heal. Kind of began to heal, you know. And I took on some more people to sponsor, you know, and he and I got real close, and he'd talk to me about his stuff and everything. He's a wonderful man. He's as down to earth as spit, you know. Just as opposite from me as anything in the world. And I love him so much and credit him with helping to save my life because it was in danger. It's a good thing I healed. Because that wife who had left me killed herself in a head-on collision. Less than 2 months after my mother died. Her grandmother, who was a dear friend and an AA member, less than a week after she was killed, died. The lady who was so close to me in Alcoholics Anonymous that I called her my second mother and sent her a card every Mother's Day, she died. It was like people were dying all over the place. I was diagnosed with emphysema, high blood pressure, deep venous thrombophlebitis. Did I grieve? Yes. Did I explode a few times? Yes. Was I depressed? Yes. But let me tell you what didn't happen. Not once did I think about taking a drink. My sanity has been restored. Thank God Almighty for that and for the realization of that. That's what this program gives me. It removes those blinders and enables me to see things as they really are. And boy, am I grateful for that right now. I've given up on the big things and I'm never going to be totally honest, totally unselfish, totally pure. Oh my God, that's out of my understanding, you know? I'm not going to be total anything. What a relief that is. You know what I try to do? I try to be kind, nice, polite, considerate, and compassionate to everybody I meet. That's all. And I'm not very successful in a monetary way, I suspect, you know? But if I can lay down on my head on my pillow tonight and say, were you kind to everyone you met? Did you even try to be kind and polite and nice and considerate? And I can say, yes, I'm among the wealthiest men on the face of God's earth because I have expressed Him one more time. And that's what I'm here for, is to express God. We're all expressions of God. Everything created by God expresses God. And I believe that with all my heart. You know that daddy of mine that I love so much? When I was 18 years old, a judge gave me an ultimatum. Go to jail or go to the service. And I got patriotic real quick. Went down to join the United States Air Force, you know, and Daddy took me down to go off on the bus, and while he was telling me how much he loved me, he had his hand planted firmly on my butt, pushing me on that bus. He wanted me out of his life. I was driving him and Mama crazy. And Daddy died with lung cancer, and it was a long, ugly, ugly thing, but it was the most beautiful experience of my entire life. We became good friends again, lovers, if you will, after I got sober. And that man loved me like I can't understand. And I loved him back in a way I can't understand. And I watched him suffer nobly. And the day before he died, he turned over and asked me, was he going to die? And I said, yes, sir. Does that frighten you? He said, yeah, but I learned a long time ago, when you're afraid, you give the fear to God and go about your business, son. We think we're the only ones that know that. And then he looked at me and he said, Tommy, I love you. You're one of the finest men I've ever known in my life. How's that? I'm 18 years old. He's pushing me up on a bus. After being in this program for a few years, he's telling me I'm one of the finest men he's ever known. I got a son in the program now. 4.5 years sober, okay? Bless his heart, he's a spitting image of me, you know? And he's just the finest young man. I just glory in watching him stay sober, you know? And he introduced me one night to talk. He said, the speaker tonight's the finest man I've ever known in my life. He's my hero. He's my father. I've had 2 boys named after me. I have 3 goddaughters. That's pretty good for a drunk right there, ain't it? Among my best friends are little children. I'm trying my best to become like one of them again. Simple and honest and open and loving. I don't think it's any accident that the greatest of all spiritual teachers said, if you want to be filled, turn around and become like a little child again. And I believe in that. I want to close tonight. A friend of mine from Alabama gave me a tape one time by a singer named Eddie Kilburn. He said, I want you to listen. This just reminds me of you. And I listen to this one song, you know. I want to share it with you tonight if I can remember the words, as if it were a dialogue between myself and my 3 children and my mother and me, if you'll bear with me. My oldest daughter's named Christy. And Christy says, Daddy, why aren't you famous? I said, Christy, I think I am. Because all the people you see here tonight came out here to give me a hand. But their applause isn't what really matters. It's what I can feel from their hearts. And if tonight I made dreamers of some who had lost them, I made friends with a few who were scared, or if there's one new believer who came here a critic and I told him that somebody cared, then Christy, I always feel famous, though I'm not seen on TV. I get all the attention my ego can handle doing this live and for free. You see, I do it live and for free. My youngest daughter, Frances, says, but Daddy, why are you lonely? I said, Frances, I guess I am. Because there are a few people that I miss tonight who aren't here to give me a hand. But you know what? In some ways, they're closer than the people out on the front row. And if I'm quiet, I can hear Grumpy's heart beating rhythm. See Chuck C. driving his car. And there are preachers and poets that I never met, like Bill Wilson, who hasn't gone far. So I'm alone, but I'm not really lonely. I just got a group you can't see. They give me all the companionship my faith can handle doing this talking with me. You see, they do this talking with me. My son Jason says, but Daddy, I think you're crazy. I said, Jason, that's what keeps me sane. I was born with a strange sense of humor to go with a strong sense of pain. And I found that there's nothing so serious that it can't hold its own in a joke. So I may smile at stories about people suffering and laugh about losing my hat. Make people think I give talks without answers because I tease them and hide where they're at. But I also love things that are simple. And a smile is the last thing you'll see on the face of this crazy old outlaw. Laughing out loud because I'm me. I laugh like this because I'm free. Then my black belt Southern Baptist mother says in her inimitable way, "But Tommy, do you love Jesus?" And I said, "Mother, doesn't it show?" She said, "I've been listening to you for an hour, and frankly, I got to say no. Because if you did, you'd be famous. Big concerts and Christian TV. You'd be so well known that you'd never get lonely, you'd never be crazy or weird. But you got to give up giving talks without answers, and you ought to shave off that old beard." And I said, "Well, I love you too, Mother, but you sure found it different than me. You see, I do my best, and I do it like Jesus, because he did it live and for free." Thank you.